It's impossible for Owen to be sure of what impact his photos will have. For others involved in the North Sea oil industry, though, there are more traditional ways to try and get things changed. As we've heard, it was the Piper Alpha disaster that galvanised many, like Bob Ballantyne, into taking action.
And I always remember when I came into Aberdeen and thinking it then, that, no, I'm not going back to the paper, I'm not going back offshore again. I looked around me and I could see the greenery as we came into Aberdeen, I could see the trees, I could see people. So I'd made a conscious decision then that here I was in terra firma, that I would never ever go offshore again. And I made that conscious decision while I was in the water.
Working conditions on oil rigs throughout the UK and the rest of the world vary enormously. Geographer Andy Cumbers.
If you look at the UK, where there's been very little early government regulation of the oil industry, where American multinationals could more or less bring their own sets of industrial employment relations into the North Sea, we saw a very hostile environment for workers, and we saw no recognition of trade unions, and we saw very poor health and safety standards. And of course, to some extent, that environment contributed to the Piper Alpha disaster. If you look at the situation in Norway, a very different situation emerged in terms of time spans. We're talking about parallel development, I think. What happened in Norway is that right from the very start, there was a much more regulated, a much more consensual approach to oil development, where the labour and the trade unions were involved from a very early stage. And to some extent, what was developed was a kind of Scandinavian model of employment relations as opposed to American one, which was developed effectively in the UK sector of the North Sea. So you saw recognition of unions, you saw much better wages and conditions, you saw a much higher level of union membership in Norway compared to the UK.
The only way that workers in the UK can be sure their safety will be taken really seriously is organising themselves through an active trade union. Ronnie MacDonald.
I've heard this phrase, risk transfer mechanism. You can actually see that working offshore at the moment, where the decision to cut back in maintenance clearly is risky. So you're taking a chance. Now, where is that risk being passed to? It's being passed to the workforce, because they're the ones who are going to die. Now, that very same workforce, because of the system of contractorisation and subcontractorisation, is powerless to resist. They're not consulted about decisions not to maintain. If an employee of a contractor were to complain to his employer about it, he would be told, comply or leave. And certainly the employer, the contractor, is not going to go to the client and confront the client. So when Shell or others decide to transfer the risk to the workforce, expose them to more risk as a part of a decision to cut back in maintenance, there is only one mechanism available to the workforce to resist that, and that is the regulator, the Health and Safety Executive, the Offshore Safety Division. But they themselves increasingly have been nobbled. We have this so-called agenda of partnership being sponsored by the government at the moment, where confrontation is no longer part of the framework of discussion and partnership in health and safety. Is utter baloney, and people are being killed as a consequence.
General Secretary of OILC, which became a certified trade union in 1992, is Jake Malloy. He says what this doesn't do is address the responsibility of the company to ensure that workers can in fact work safely.
They're actually trying to shift the blame, as it were, in the event of an incident or an accident, further and further down the line to the workforce, through initiatives such as personal responsibility for safety. I mean, I've just read a letter where a scaffolder has bent over into a basket and pulled a bag of scaffold fittings, probably about 20 kilos, out of the bottom of the basket and has burst a hernia. A hernia he obviously didn't know he had until he made this lift. He's been sacked for it because it's irresponsibility on his part to even lift in that manner. No consideration of the fact that that's the only means by which you can get these fittings out of the basket, because there's no mechanical means or an opening in the basket that allows you to push some mechanical means into it. It's purely about shifting blame further and further down the line.
Jake is in no doubt where the responsibility lies. Only a short time ago, two men died on one of Shell's platforms, the Brent Bravo, suffocated by a gas leak while patching a corroded pipe.
no managers, even supervisors at platform level, but moreover, the real controllers, if you like, the asset managers, the people that sit onshore and pass down instructions and authorise some of the actions, like the Brent Bravo deaths, authorising the offshore supervisors, managers to install temporary patches which frankly weren't fit for purpose. Nobody is held accountable above the workforce level. Absolutely no one. Not one individual has been put in a witness box and asked why. Because of the system here in Scotland, the ability simply to turn up to the court, plead guilty for two breaches of the Health and Safety at Work Act, apologise, offer up mitigation, pay peppercorn fines and walk away. I mean, even in the case of the two deaths in Brent Bravo, Shell were fined £900,000. But if you look at the news yesterday morning, you'll see they're making £30 million a day. So it's less than 45 minutes of profit. It's peanuts, whilst the families are left with no answers. And nobody, but nobody, is held to account to answer why.
Organising trade unions in the oil industry has always been difficult, and until very recently, oil companies have been reluctant to recognise trade unions. Andy Cumbers points out that, even with more positive attitudes, organising a union of oil workers has its own problems.
There is a problem with nationally organised unions, I think, in trying to deal with globalisation. But the other side of that, I think, is that the problem with the UK oil industry is that the way that the industry was organised around, you know, having national headquarters and regional offices and so on, is that when you saw this new space develop in the North Sea, where actually most of the workers that work there, they're itinerant and they're travelling away from the place of work every 2 or 3 weeks to go home again, how do you collectively organise an industry where people aren't based in fixed places territorially, but actually it's quite a dispersed workforce? So that's one thing the unions didn't really get a handle on. They didn't realise that they actually need very new organisational geographies to organise the workforce. And that was something the oil companies were able to play on, the fact that they have these workers who work for 2 or 3 weeks on a rig, that they're physically, you know, separated from the rest of the country. They're in this very small world. Employers can almost totally control what goes on there. And then these people, when they finish their work, they go home to kind of dispersed communities and places. If you extrapolate that up to a global level, how you can keep a track on a workforce that's constantly moving around. What you'll have, of course, is you'll have individual union members who have a very strong union consciousness, who will travel from Aberdeen, say, to Nigeria, witness some terrible atrocity in Nigeria, and will report back to their union. And very often that is flagged up, and that is a way that you do get international union rights developing. But that's on an individual basis. You know, it's very difficult to organise more collectively, globally, in this dispersed workforce that's going around the world and being shifted.
The problem is that even if unions work globally, they don't recognise local unions in the countries in which they operate. But in Norway, the situation is different. They have just signed an agreement which recognises the right of unions there to organise collectively wherever they operate in the world.
What's interesting now, if we think about how the industry actually operates internationally, is that these different national models are to some extent being exported to other countries. So if you look at, say, BP and Shell and how they operate internationally, they'll take a model of not recognising unions in the countries they work in overseas. If you compare that with the main Norwegian oil company that works internationally, Statoil, it's a very different situation. In 1998, they signed what was called a global frame agreement, which actually recognises the rights of unions to and labour to organise collectively wherever Statoil operate in the world. And they're the only oil company that's actually done that. So it's a nice example of a national or perhaps a Nordic model of employment relations being exported internationally into the global arena. And I think these different national contrasts in the way that multinationals operate are becoming increasingly important for things like human and labour rights globally.
And even though having a dispersed and mobile workforce might seem an ideal opportunity to use the internet, forging a virtual community of platform workers, there are still drawbacks. To be organised, people still need face-to-face contact in order to build relationships and trust, and also to make sure that decisions that are made get put into action.
So although the global frame agreements do seem on the surface to be an excellent thing and a real step forward for global trade union organising, there are problems when it comes to the local implementation of these agreements. Because, for example, if you take the Statoil agreement, which is between, obviously, the Norwegian head office and management of Statoil and the Norwegian union to recognised labour rights globally, the implementation of that agreement is then dependent on local management. And it's there that you often get the abuses of labour and human rights. And of course, the parent company may not even know about how that's going on, or they may decide to turn a blind eye. So you may have a global agreement that sounds very nice and presses all the right buttons and meets International Labour Organization standards. But actually, what gets carried out locally is very much dependent on local industrial relations and local management regimes.
We've seen in this CD how the globalisation of oil has affected those who work with it. And we have also discussed the importance of responsibility for worker safety on the oil platforms, which, by their very nature, are in some of the most hostile maritime environments in the world. The industrial situation and critical issue of the union representation offshore is a highly complex one, but it is in this context that Owen Logan's photographs should be viewed. Despite hanging in a rather obscure staircase in the Scottish Parliament building, they nevertheless alert us to the experiences of those intimately involved with oil, and will perhaps provoke discussion and debate, which, after all, is what they were designed to do.
I wouldn't overplay the impact that my images or anyone else's images can have in the politics of the Parliament building. Far from it. I mean, in a way, the way the images are displayed tells you something. These pictures are way on a stairwell in the dark, whereas other images, which are much more friendly to the current political establishment, which use words in their titles, which are used by government, they are very, very prominently displayed and given pride of place. So the way the images are used in this context just reflects the politics of what's going on in the building, really. So it'd be naive to really expect the images to have an impact, but I still feel it's important that they're there and that I did a project which is about this rather than something else.